Get ready. Mike Tirico is about to pull you in with the biggest names in sports.
Rodgers firing, and it is Davante Adams for the touchdown.
I have to say that I've been a fan of the game for years. I mean, I grew up watching Super Bowl highlights on an old VHS tape when wearing that thing out.
Mike's got you covered for the PGA Tour, the Triple Crown, Notre Dame football, and Football Night in America.
You can't cover all of these things.
It's the Mike Tirico Podcast.
This marks the beginning of a new broadcast era.
Mike Tirico, Godspeed.
Thank you for downloading the podcast. A little downshift, if you will, this week. We're going to put the NFL talk aside just for a bit. Of course, we'll ramp up heavy here when we go through the back end of the season. But in a little bit, we're going to talk to Dale Earnhardt Jr. about not just like the racing that's going to happen this weekend with NASCAR wrapping up its season in Homestead. The season championship is on the line. But we're going to talk about the things around that sport because they're in a time of transition. And Dale Jr. is also going to give you unbelievable insight into going from playing a sport, in his case driving, to being in the booth. You talk about the TV analysts all the time and the guys who jump right in. There's some stuff that you don't hear or see about, and Dale's going to be really candid with you on what the probably biggest hurdle facing those individuals has been and has been for him and how he's trying to get over it. So it's really interesting stuff from Junior coming up in a little bit. We'll get to Dale Earnhardt. But first, Brian Kelly. Notre Dame plays Syracuse on Saturday. It is by far the best game on the college football schedule. Notre Dame ranked third. Syracuse in the top 12, I should say, going into this one. And it's a battle that puts Notre Dame one step closer, if they win, to getting to the college football playoff. And that's the way you measure things in South Bend, by championships. So no hiding here. I'm a Syracuse alum, very proud of it. Have had a great time calling the Notre Dame games. And part of that experience has been getting to know Brian Kelly. So let's visit with the Irish coach to start the pod off today. Coach, you're a Red Sox fan, so you get to go to Yankee Stadium and feel at home, right?
No doubt. Well, we have the trophy, so there's nothing to worry about.
Can you tell people, because we get in the middle of the season, we're dealing with quarterbacks and all this other stuff. Can you tell folks about some of your early days in Boston? I thought one of the most fascinating stories you told me was 3 years ago when I started to do these games, how there was a time there that you thought your life may not have been football, but politics and being around the political scene a little bit.
Well, when I graduated, I went to work in the State House in Boston. So, you know, obviously being downtown, being part of, you know, the Boston Five, you know, you're going to be a professional sports fan in Boston. And certainly one of the teams that you've got to follow are the Boston Red Sox. So spend many nights at Fenway Park and have a lot of great memories.
That's so awesome. And your time being around and thinking about potentially the political spectrum and watching that, obviously it told you to go to football. But how does it help? how does it help manage a job like being, one, a college football head coach, and then a very different level of that, being the head coach at Notre Dame?
Well, I was in organizational work, so grassroots organizational work. So, you know, working with many different interest groups, young people, to get them out to vote, register them to vote. So I think a lot of that organizational work, working with people on a day-to-day basis, and then as I, you know, worked in the State House, you know, during the day, you know, a lot of more, you know, day-to-day organizational work, but much more detailed on bills and that process and how detailed it is. So it was great. I got the detailed work that you need in terms of planning and practice work and things of that nature. And then I got the hands-on organizational work that you need with your players and team. So I think a lot of that really helped me, you know, with my career later.
So fascinating. Fast forward to being a head coach now. The analytics part of this, the advanced levels of recruiting and all of the other things, how difficult has the job become compared to when you first became a head coach? And by the way, for the folks who don't realize your incredible career, you've left the field, the winning head coach, 250 times, which is just an extraordinary number when you step back and think about, you know, a good season's 8-9 wins, and you've done this so many times. What is it like to see this evolution of what the job of a head coach has to entail right now?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with understanding, the different roles that you now have, and you have to know people. I think that's what's happened here, is that you're now easily insulated with a number of different people that have roles that you never had when I started. I had two full-time assistant coaches. I handed out the $5 bill for meal when we went to McDonald's on the road trip on the way back. I did the laundry on Sunday nights.
Oh my gosh.
And today I have a support staff that's upward of 50 people. So that doesn't include the coaching staff. So it's important that you understand the roles and responsibilities and how important they are, and empowering those people to do their jobs, and that you understand what they are. That's really the intricacies today with the position.
How about the Notre Dame job? Because that is something, I guess, that nobody can jump in there fully prepared for what that fishbowl is like. And along the way here, I'm sure you've continued to grow and learn and understand it. When did you feel comfortable with how far-reaching the power of Notre Dame football is still in college football?
Well, keep in mind, I had 19 years as a head coach when I took the job on, and I don't think I was actually adequately prepared for it. So that will put it at, probably the measure of, yeah, of the enormity of the position. So I think it's expectations, certainly, which is understandable. But I think it's probably because it's more than just football. It's an ambassador for the university. Football is within the fabric of the university, and so you're much more than just a football coach. You're representing the university in so many different ways. And look, whether we acknowledge it or not, there are tough times when you are the preeminent Catholic university in the country. There are tough times for the Catholic Church right now, and so there's a lot of there's another side of who likes Notre Dame and who doesn't like Notre Dame. So all that comes with the job that nobody else clearly has.
What about the players? Because seeing it firsthand and understanding what the academic requirements, what the commitment is internally, you cannot necessarily just throw a vast net out there and say, hey, we'll take all comers. There has to be a fit. And as you recruit nationally, how difficult is it to find the right fit of the right people who not only can get into Notre Dame, but can survive, then thrive as academic students as well as just the football?
Right. So like any other successful business, there has to be two things that you look for in the interviewing process. One, do they have the skills to work in your company? Mm-hmm. And certainly here at Notre Dame, that would be the skills in the classroom and then the skills on the football field. And then do they fit culturally in your company or organization? So the big one for us is that we can generally find the skills both in the classroom and certainly on the football field throughout the country because we recruit nationally. It's the cultural fit. It's the ability to live in the dorms with the other students. It's the ability to integrate on campus because it's not just about football. It's about being involved involved in community here at the university. And you have to choose to do that, and you have to be engaged. So that's probably the hardest thing in the recruiting process. And so you can't sell somebody a bill of goods on that. You have to do your due diligence and be transparent in that process.
You guys were 4-8 2 years ago and have had two double-digit win seasons. Do you ever get a moment to just briefly step back and appreciate the changes that you've made, the cultural impact that it's made within the football building, and that you've won 19 out of 21 games against, you know, very, very few easy opponents. This has been a pretty impressive turnaround. Yet, because it's Notre Dame, there's the standard of, if it's not a national championship, man, it was a good try, but it wasn't good enough. What has it felt like internally to kind of get this thing back going in the direction that you had hoped you could?
Yeah, while you were throwing bouquets, I'll say one more. We've won more bowl games. We've beaten more bowl teams than any team in college football, including Alabama. So I figured, while we're at it, we'll throw that one in there too. Because there's not many times you can up Alabama on anything when
it comes
to football.
That's true.
You know, what I look at is you know, my first job I was at for 13 years at Grand Valley, and I was learning how to be a head football coach. Then I went 3 years at Central Michigan, turned a program around, and I went 3 years at Cincinnati, turned a football program around. I came here in 3 years, and we went played for the national championship. And so I'd been on that three-year turnaround.
Yeah.
And then got here after the third year and really went past that three-year turnaround again and stopped doing the things that I had been doing in the process that I had always stuck with. So the 4-8 season was a reawakening of getting back to the things that I had always done. And it just validates the fact that if I just stick with the process and the things that I've always done as a football coach, that we can have success.
This team this year has shown something with Ian Book when he came in at quarterback, but that wasn't an easy decision because Brandon Wimbush was very well liked by his teammates. How have you watched the dynamic of the team handle a situation like that, and at least outwardly, and then, you know, from a little bit more inside than other people get from what we've experienced and seen, it's been done very calmly and done within the spirit of keeping the team together when you make such a significant change like that?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I've had some that haven't worked out, but it always centers around the individuals, and those individuals can make this work or can make it difficult. And so, Brandon Wimbush is the kind of young man that saw this as a challenge to him, and that he was going to take this adversity and it was going to make him stronger. So his attitude allowed this for us to grow as a football team. And that's why you saw me take a timeout and take him out of the game, thanking him for the way he's handled himself. And our players love him. But at the end of the day, they want to win too. And they see that Ian Book is a guy that can lead us to wins. So that's why it's worked so well.
And lastly, you have Syracuse and USC on the schedule as you prepare here for Syracuse this week. They've scored a lot of points, 5 times over 50 this year, which will kind of put a little bit of attention on your defense. And you've brought in a defensive coordinator in Clark Lee this year who has done a terrific job to this point. Talk about what the challenge is going to be against Syracuse on Saturday at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, this is really a great job by Dino Babers in the sense that, you know, he's gone 4-8, 4-8, and now he's got an 8-2 team. But what people lose sight of is that he has not wavered from where he started. In other words, it's easy if you hadn't been a head coach before, which he was at Eastern Illinois and Bowling Green, to go away from what he has done. And he stuck with his system. He's developed his players. And now these young men are now veterans on the offensive line. He's gone out and brought in some veteran players on the defensive line, and now he can do things on the line of scrimmage that he couldn't do before. So they present a challenge because they can run the football, they can throw it, they're balanced on offense, they're not just a finesse spread offense. And they can get after the pass, the quarterback. And so those are the basic tenets of football. You don't win by being cute. And he's a smart football coach, and he's developed Syracuse into a winning team. And the challenges will not just be on defense. They'll be, in special teams, offense and defense. And that's why this is going to be a heck of a good football game.
That's pretty cool. Notre Dame plays in Chicago and New York and L.A., all in the same one. It's not easy for the football coach to get his team around the country and do all that, but it does speak to what Brian is really, as we wrap up, unique about this job. That, as you said before, Notre Dame is not a regional team in the South. It is truly perhaps the last national team left in college football because of the recruiting and the fan base and where you guys go to play and challenge yourselves on a regular basis, too.
Yeah, we're an on-Broadway play. We open up in a town near you pretty soon. we go from San Diego to Chicago to New York to L.A. Our kids sign up for this. They know it's a rigorous schedule, but we're well-rested and excited about the trip to New York.
Man, it's been fun being around you guys the last couple of years. Look forward to the game in the city and watch what happens here the last few. Thanks for a few minutes, Brian. We'll see you in New York.
Okay, take care, Mike.
Our thanks to Brian. Very wide-ranging stuff, which I like. You see the football coach, but you don't hear a bunch of the other stuff that he does. It's pretty special. Okay, NASCAR, we are down to four for the playoffs. The finale comes at Homestead, NBC, 2 o'clock on Sunday. Dale Earnhardt Jr., of course, on the call. He's been NASCAR's most popular driver, incredibly successful, continued the legacy of his dad. First year going from the track to the booth. A lot of good stuff to talk about with Dale Earnhardt Jr. Let's visit with one of our favorite guys here on the podcast. Well, it is, it's the wrap-up for NASCAR, so we're going to ask Dale Jr. about that here in a moment. And we're also going to ask about football because I've seen it with my own eyes. He's a big Washington Redskins fan. He's all in on his Redskins, who are still in first place. But I want to ask you, Dale, about the year. Here you are at the end of the run of what is a long year, but your first year doing the media, the TV deal. What's your biggest takeaways from doing it so far?
Well, man, there's a few. I'm just kind of overwhelmed with a feeling of. I know this is going to sound strange, but I feel so blessed to have this opportunity. And having race cars all my life, I knew that was going to end one day. I had no idea what I was going to do with myself after I got done driving cars, and I knew I needed something that kept me busy and made me feel like I was part of a team and had those kind of same character traits that what I was getting out of the race car, what I was getting out of driving a race car. So this opportunity to be a broadcaster and get in the booth with NBC just seemed to materialize in the last couple of years. And I just never would have imagined I'd have that opportunity. I dreamed about it. I thought about it. Even as a little kid when I was racing Maxbox cars on the floor, I imagined I would broadcast my races. Me and my friends would broadcast and emulate what we heard on the radio and TV from the announcers. And I never dreamed that I'd be able to do that. So at the end of this, coming to the end of my first year, I feel so fortunate to have been able to have this opportunity. It was a lot more work than I could have imagined. I knew it was going to be, a work, but I didn't understand exactly what that work looked like, what preparing was like,
right?
What I needed to do, what I needed to be doing during the week. And obviously, race car driver, you hardly ever find yourself in the TV compound. You don't really know exactly what the production company means when you hear that word, production company. And, there's hundreds of people they're responsible for getting everything from one racetrack to the next set up, torn apart, put together week after week after week. And it's a huge operation. And so you learn that right away. And there's so many moving parts and individuals responsible for every little detail that make it happen. And, you know, without that one person here and there, it's really impressive. So much goes into making event come across the TV screen. It's just so incredibly impressive. And being a small part of it's been fun. I've gotten that team feeling from it that I got in the race car, being a part, being one person that, right. of a bigger group. All those things have been really rewarding.
Well, you've jumped in. I got to see it firsthand this summer when I visited you guys for a week. You've jumped in and been a huge part of it. So Dale, I worked with Curtis Strange when he was kind of straddling the fence of being still a golfer and coming in the booth to work the ABC coverage. And I've worked with John Gruden when he came right off the field and right into the booth. I know it's hard on those guys specifically when you're just a year removed and you're in a position where, you know, you're not trying to carve guys up on a regular basis, but you have to say some honest, sometimes critical things of your peers, of guys who you have relationships with, or plain out friends. How tough has that been as an adjustment for you this year?
That's been tough. That's probably the most challenging part about it, because and your personality, those are roadblocks. You know, when you see a friend or another driver do something that you know you have to call straight down the middle. You know you have to be critical or say this guy made a mistake. In your personality, you run into this giant roadblock of, man, that's not who I am. I don't call people out. I don't talk. I don't go out of my way to speak negatively about someone. But you got viewers that are watching the race that depend on you to be honest, and they themselves have an opinion of what they saw.
Right.
And they know when you are skirting the truth or dancing around the bush or avoiding the truth. And so that's a real challenge, because these relationships that you have with these drivers, at the same time, is critical to your success as a broadcaster. You have to be able to call these guys, lean on these guys, communicate with them throughout the year. If they feel like you've wronged them or said something that wasn't correct or were overly critical to them, they can cut that communication off and not right. want to be forthcoming in information that you need to make a more make a better broadcast. So It's a difficult balance, and I've talked to my booth mates, Jeff mm-hmm. Burton, Rick Allen, Letart, about that, how they go about navigating that, and the drivers get upset with them with some of the things they'll say. Crew chiefs do; they'll call during the week, they'll talk it out, and usually work it out and create some respect and trust. Even you got to have some trust with those guys, so they believe, you know, so they trust you with the information they're giving you. So I think I'm at the beginning of building those relationships and building that trust and building that credibility with the drivers and the crew chiefs in the garage. And it's up to me to make sure that I do a good job of that, so that, you know, I'll have the opportunity when I reach out to them during the week preparing for the next race or whatever. Anytime I reach out to them, they want to talk. They want to work with me and help me.
Exactly. I always tell people who jump into this that that's one of the toughest things, because, of course, you've got to be loyal to your viewers. Like you said, they know the deal. The ones who are watching understand it. By the same token, you've been criticized, so you know sometimes people aren't accurate when they're making criticism, or there's a reason, and maybe you don't want to sell somebody on your crew down the road or the sponsor or something like that. So you have to find that fine line in that right place to please everybody, and usually you never do, and you end up over time, as you get farther away from it, a year removed, couple of years removed, 5 years removed, then it becomes one of those things where the relationships aren't as close, and you can be a little more comfortable with that, finding that sweet spot of being who you are, at the same time being loyal to your viewers, because at the end of the day, that's your customer now. And I do have to say this to folks who wouldn't have seen this. So we're out at Daytona the one time I showed up with you guys here, 4th of July weekend, and we're out there and we're right amongst the fans, And you know, Dale Jr. just gets mobbed. I mean, it's seeing, you know, one of the most popular drivers of all time right there, just in the stands. And it reminded me how NASCAR drivers are connected to their fans so much better than any other athlete in any other sport. And I'm not knocking the others. I'm just giving props to the people who do it, because you guys do have a better understanding of those are your customers. And if they're not buying the shirts, and if they're not supporting the product and the sponsors, you guys don't have a sport. And you guys have never lost from what your dad and all the guys before did. They understood that it was about giving the people a show every time they spent their hard-earned money to come to the track. And that I admire that as the day and age has changed, the money's gone up. You guys have helped keep the roots of the sport still very, very, very present for the fans when they get to run into you guys.
Yeah, I think that we had drivers like Richard Petty has always kind of been the standard, the guy that's the best example of this. But Richard Petty would always reach out and sign autographs, sit down and take care of every fan, any request at any opportunity he could. And a lot of drivers or, you know, around that era from the 50s and 60s and 70s were the same way. They set the standard that other drivers followed through the 80s into the 90s. My father, Jeff Gordon, I mean, the list goes on and on. You watch, when you would walk around, watch these guys move around the racetrack and do what they did, the access the fan had and how they allowed the fan to have that access and accommodated the fan was always consistent. So that's something that, you know, I think anytime I've had, let's just say, for example, Peyton Manning come out to a race, and he couldn't believe the access the fans had down on pit road before the race. They literally can come up to the drivers right as the drivers are getting ready to get in the car.
You were telling me that. I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah. Yeah, he looked at me and said, is this like this all the time? Is this the way it is every week? Because he just couldn't believe it. The fans that had that kind of access and could go free, you know, pretty much if they had the right credential, could go wherever they needed to go or wanted to go. And I've been to football games and seen how the quarterback or the player can isolate himself from everyone, even his own teammates, to prepare mentally, getting in that zone that he wants to get into and go over those final details that he thinks he needs to go over for that game plan. And so it's not that one's right or wrong. It's just a different in culture and different in – it's a difference in how things have been done over the years. And race car drivers were doing autographs all the way up until they climbed in the car in the 50s and 60s. It's been the same way ever since. They created the standard that we live by. And, you know, I always find it surprising when we get I love it when we get athletes, successful athletes from other sports to come to our sport and see the difference in the way we do it. And they always kind of come away with a big surprise to the access the fans have. And we're in a time in our sport where we have to be that accommodating. We need to be that accommodating, and we're always trying to create new experiences for the fans. We just came from Phoenix, where they spent $170 million to recreate the entire experience for the race fan, from the grandstands to the victory circle to infield access, all kinds of things, Wi-Fi in every seat, those type of things. So our sport's in a bit of a big evolution of trying to change the fan experience. That's critical. That's something that we've done since the very beginning of the organization back in the 40s and 50s, and we'll continue to allow that access, because I think that it's like about the automobile too, you know, as it is the driver of the car. The fans need to be able to get access to that car, get close to it, see how it's built, see what makes it work. Because they are the cars are as big a big a part of the they are the stars as well. So and America's affection for the automobile, I mean, that's something that we have to key in on.
That's important too, as the sport, like you said, changes the lead personalities and evolves and goes forward. Let me hit you here before we get done on Homestead and the last race. And the story was three big guys who dominated the sport this year. Now we've got Logano, Joey Logano in there with Kyle Busch and Martin Truex and Kevin Harvick. The last three were the dominant guys all year, that big three. Junior, what's it like you get to this final race and you've got four guys who've – three of them had incredible seasons. One's had a really good season. And now it's all on the line here. Kind of like a Super Bowl, kind of like a college football championship or college hoops. It all comes down to one day. What kind of pressure is that like for those guys?
Well, it's it's relatively new in our sport to decide this championship in one final event. Over decades, you basically accumulated points throughout the season. And that was, you would have guys that were winning the championship a race or two in advance of the final event. So we did have a lot of close battles that came down to the last race, but mm-hmm. someone would go into that last event with some sort of an advantage in points.
Right.
And recently the revamped point system has created a playoff system that leads us down to this final event, and we narrow the field down to four drivers with they go into this race pretty much with a blank sheet of paper, and the guy who finishes the best is the guy who wins the race. And
do you like it?
Most likely, person that has won this championship has won this race or had to win this race to win the championship. So
right. It
really forces the teams to be their best, to be the best they can be. Nobody can go in there thinking, well, I just need to finish in the top 15 to lock this up. I just need to do X, Y, and Z to lock this up. It is a must win. It's must win for the driver, for the pit crew, for the car, the crew chief calling the strategy. Every part of the team, every component has to be perfect. And I think, the fact that we narrow it down, we have four of the best teams in the garage that are going to be fighting for this. And I think that it is a great way to decide the best of the best. Homestead, the track that we're going to, is an incredible racetrack that offers multiple grooves of racing, a lot of different ways to get around that place. I think it's a driver's racetrack. You have to really understand what you're doing with the race car. There's a lot of racetracks where maybe the driver is a bigger key component or the car may be a bigger key component. Here, I believe it's pretty much 50-50.
Cool.
And it's just an incredible place to be able to decide it. So it's boiling down to what will more than likely be a very dramatic event. We've since the NBC coverage started at Chicago, all these races have been crazy. I mean, the energy and excitement intensity has been unlike anything I've seen in many years. These drivers are really going out of their way and over extending themselves in a lot of situations, creating a lot of, a lot of eventful moments in these races, whether it's crashes or guys taking advantage of each other. Everybody seems to really tested the morals here over the past several months. And we saw in Phoenix just this past weekend, so many things happening that were changing who was going to be the final four going into Homestead. We went into that race thinking Kevin Harvick was going to dominate. He had trouble. Chase Elliott looked to be seizing his opportunity to be one of the final four to go to Homestead. Then he had a mistake on pit road. Kurt Busch was then in position to seize that opportunity, and he also had a mistake coming on the pit road. And then there was a crash that took both Chase and Kurt out of the race.
Right.
And it seemed to hand deliver Harvick his opportunity to go to Homestead. Well, then in the final few restarts, Eric Almirola was up there with a chance to seize a win and take that spot from Harvick. So we really didn't know who the final four were going to be up until the very last few laps of that race. And it was just really exciting and exactly what we've been yearning for as a sport. The point system, really, I've actually drove in this system with stages.
Mm-hmm.
We have, stages throughout the races where you can accumulate points and so forth.
Right.
I have felt the intensity inside the car because of these changes and because of how we have the stages in the races and go into the playoffs and so forth. I've been in that playoff system and felt that intensity ratchet up as we go through that system. It's asking a lot of these drivers emotionally and mentally. It's always been physical, but it's really pushing these guys to the limit mentally on what they can handle. And I don't know of a more difficult thing to try to do in motorsport than to go into one race with four guys, and whoever wins is the champion. That's just going to be incredibly challenging mentally for each of these drivers to hold it together that entire race without making mistakes, getting their car into the fence or anything. But also, they have to run their best. They can't They can't pace themselves and dial it back. They have to push as hard as they can the entire race. It's going to be impressive. Whoever accomplishes this goal of winning the championship has going to dang sure earned it.
I got a really, really quick question for you, and then I'll wrap up with the Redskins. Just a quick answer. So you've been in this race. How conscious are the drivers who are not the four? How conscious are they of everyone else in the of those other guys who are going for the championship? And then what do you do in those situations where you're racing your tail off? You're trying to get a win for your team and for your sponsors and all that stuff, but you don't want to be the guy who gets in the way of the championship. But maybe you've got just a great car and a perfect setup, and you've done the fuel mileage right, and you've played the whole deal the right way. What do you do if you're in position and you got guys battling around you who you know are battling for the championship?
You go to every race to win. So every driver there that shows up this weekend wants to win that race. You do exactly as you said. You stay out of the way to a point. You don't want to do anything that's going to put one of those guys in a bad position or cause them to crash, or you don't want to be responsible for that.
Right.
But at the same time, you got to go out there and run and win and drive your race. So if you have the car that's capable of winning, go by all means. You have every right to go up there and try to win that race. But you got to balance that between, hey, if I take one of these guys out, do I want to hear, read that in the media all during the entire off season? Do I want to have to talk to this driver about that mistake? Do I want to have to be that guy that gets pegged as the one responsible for it by the public and the fans? That's something that you have to decide. It's basically a test of morals, what you're willing to do.
That's fascinating, because we talked about that forever. If you're the guy who, you know, you just get a guy in the rear coming off the turn, just spin him a little bit and on that last lap and keep him from a title. It's a fascinating part of this. All right, let me wrap up with your Redskins. I thought you guys were done. You know, 5-3 and all the injuries on the offensive line, and then they go down to Tampa. They give up 500 yards, but they only give up 3 points, and they find a way to win, and here they are with what happened with Dallas and Philly on Sunday night. Junior, you guys are a couple of games to the good in the NFC East here. There's a real chance they could win the division this year.
Yeah, there's a chance we could win a division. We still got to play Philly twice, and as you know, they could figure out what's going on and get their stuff together any moment. They got a lot of talent, and obviously coming off a championship, they're a championship caliber team. Dallas, you know, it depends on who's going to show up. When you go play Dallas, who's going to show up? The Dallas that beat Philly, or, you know, the Dallas that we played the last time? You just never know with these teams. And Eli Manning always has this weird way of being able to beat us no matter what. If he comes and can put it together. So I don't think those are easy wins. Those are four games that we have to win, but they're not going to be easy at all. They could go either way. And but I think if we can get, you know, a couple division wins, that we're going to easily win the division. Still, though, you know, when we play the Falcons or the Saints and get blown out like that, it doesn't give you a ton of confidence for the team going forward beyond the division. You know, obviously the injuries in the offensive line are really going to, you know, challenge this team to be productive. The run game with Adrian Peterson was really helping us early in the season.
Sure was.
Without that offensive line being productive, can he continue to do that? Can he continue to carry that load and put the yards down that we need to manage these games and allow our quarterback to play the way he wants to play? Without a running game, I don't know that we're going to have a very successful offense. So no. We can't seem to be very consistent through the air. We're not going downfield taking chances and getting the yardage in the passing game that I think everybody was hoping we would. So
But that's Alex Smith's deal. We've known that. That's the way Alex plays. Your defense, Greg Minuski, your defensive coordinator, has got those guys up front playing. He always does, and that's going to give you a chance in every one of these games, I think.
I agree, yeah. I love what we've done for the defense to make it stronger, make it tougher. It's definitely keeping us in these games, helping us win games. We're not putting up a ton of points, so if we're going to win games, we're going to have to keep their offense limited.
Well, I love listening to your podcast. Your book's terrific. I had a chance to thumb through it. It's really cool. I'm glad everybody at home's doing good. It's been a big year for you, and one of the cool things for us, going back to Olympics and Super Bowl and NHL Stanley Cup Finals and come down to your turf there, has been to get to be around you a little bit, because you are as good as it gets. Have a fun time at Homestead. We'll have you guys up in our screening room. We'll be watching, and we look forward to catching up with you down the road, Junior. Congrats on a great first year in TV, man.
Thanks, Mike. I can't wait to see you again, man. You guys take care. Have fun.
Hope you enjoy that stuff from Junior. And I'm going to tell you, he is such a big Redskins fan. We would do the Washington games on Monday nights, and Dale would be in the booth right next door. He'd come very often, and he absolutely loves his Redskins. You can hear the detail he was giving you, how much he enjoys that team. By the way, his book is out. It is kind of cool. Everybody who's read it has enjoyed it. Racing to the Finish is the name of the book. He co-authored it with Ryan McGee, someone who I used to work with at ESPN, who's on a little TV and radio and still writes and does a nice job over there. The two guys who were very good, and he got Dale's voice kind of locked in perfectly when he did the book. So enjoy that. Enjoy Dale Earnhardt Jr. and a really good crew from NASCAR. We'll cover the Homestead race for you on NBC Sunday. The coverage begins at 2 Eastern time. And, of course, we'll have the pregame Football Night in America before the Bears and the Vikings. And if you can be with us, hope you see us Saturday afternoon, 2:30 Eastern, for a terrific one. Notre Dame Syracuse at Yankee Stadium. Thanks to Alex Hardy for putting it together. Thank you for downloading the podcast. And we hope you have a phenomenal rest of your week.